Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and by the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, why are farmers taking their own lives? That's the subject of a new cover story in Newsweek magazine. We'll talk to the author who's explored this trend that's not just in California or in the U.S., but one that's seen across the globe. We'll also get an update from Sacramento on the effort to place a statewide moratorium on fracking. And with the June primary election just over 40 days away, we'll get a preview of some of the hot races to watch from John Ellis of the Fresno Bee. But first, the giant push to sign people up for Covered California by the end of the open enrollment period is over. But the exchange and healthcare advocates aren't just sitting back. Their new focus is letting people who meet certain criteria know they can still get coverage. Rachel Dornhelm with California Healthline brings us this report.
Family Resource Center.
With the Covered California enrollment deadline looming in March, the Oakland School District's Central Family Resource Center was flooded with calls like this one.
Hi, how can I help you?
Thanks to a big outreach effort, many parents called or came into the center for the first time during the sign-up effort. Eliza Schifrin is the center's coordinator. She says many people who still haven't come in may be eligible for Medi-Cal or the county program Health Pack. She hopes they are not dissuaded by the constant talk about the March 31st deadline.
That's great that that got a lot of people in, and at the same time, like, we want to be promoting that the most important thing is people's health, and that that's something that goes on all the time, and that we're here to support that.
The executive director of Health Access California, Anthony Wright, pointed out that the exchange is still taking in special circumstance enrollees.
We are concerned that there are some folks who may think that with all the attention with the closing the open enrollment period, that they that there's no other opportunities to enroll until November. And again, depending on income and depending on life circumstance, there are those options.
By life circumstances, he means leaving a job, getting married or divorced, adopting or birthing a child, and graduation.
We expect that there will be lots of enrollments in the months of May and June when high school and college students graduate, because that has been traditionally a major moment where people become uninsured.
Young people leave campus-based plans, he says, or in some cases, their parents' insurance. Enter the group Young Invincibles. Linda Liu, the California policy director, says the group advocates for good policy for 18 to 34-year-olds. She says they'll be doing outreach around graduation, but they'll also focus on other triggers as well.
Young adults are the ones that are going to be really well represented in almost all of these qualifying life events. I mean, 18 to 34 is a prime age for having babies, getting married. Certainly, 18 to 34-year-olds have high rates of getting married.
Lou says California did anticipate some of the need to educate people, especially in the beginning, about when they can sign up for the health exchange outside of open enrollment. She points to AB 792, a bill passed in 2012 that requires courts to notify people about the exchange when they file for divorce, marriage, or when they adopt a child. It also requires the state to provide notices to people who are disenrolled that they might be eligible for Medi-Cal or Covered California. That's a point that Kelly Hardy, Senior Director of Health Policy at Children Now, is excited about.
Half of all California children are enrolled in Medi-Cal, so that's over 4.5 million kids enrolled in Medi-Cal. And of course, there's no deadline for enrollment in Medi-Cal. That can happen at any point throughout the year.
She says that over 250,000 kids were enrolled from October through mid-February through the Covered California website, thanks to an unprecedented effort by community organizations and through social media. Ken Jacobs is the chair of the UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education. They are contracted to do modeling for Covered California about how health insurance needs will change in the new system. Jacobs says just those who will become eligible by losing coverage, say by leaving a job, is around 500,000 Californians a year.
We are talking significant numbers of people who will become eligible over the course of the year due to one of those life triggers. So it's going to be very important to reach out to make sure they understand that they can enroll and to reach them when they do experience that life trigger, because it only opens for a period of time, and so for a window. So we need to make sure that people are reached within that window.
Jacob says with the initial deadline passed, now attention can turn to the best way to extend coverage to those in transition.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. America's farmers are dying, but it's not just because they're aging. In 1978, the average age of the American farmer was 50. Today, it's around 58. But there's another even more troubling issue facing those who grow our food, farmers taking their own lives. While the numbers are in some ways hard to quantify, a new cover story in Newsweek is raising the issue of suicide on the farm to the national level. Joining us now is Max Kuttner. He is the author of Death on the Farm. Max, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Max, how did this issue first come to your attention?
So I was an undergraduate at Vassar College in upstate New York in 2010 when I first learned the story of Dean Pearson, who's the main farmer that I speak about. He killed around 51 of his cows before taking his own life back a few years ago. So that's an image that always sticks with you. And back a couple of months ago when I set out to write this article, first I had to see if it was just this one tragic incident or if it was part of a larger trend. And once I saw that not only is it an national trend, but it's also an international trend, I knew there was a big story there.
What do you think are the common threads that some of these stories all share? You document a number of them in your piece in Newsweek. All over the world, you're seeing the same sort of thing in China, in France, here in the U.S. Very disparate circumstances. Are there any connections?
There's a lot of different things that come together in different combinations. So in the U.S., we see obviously the financial struggles. If you look at the numbers of farmer suicides in the areas where they're killing themselves, you'll see that they're on par with what's going on in those industries. So the main farmer I speak about, Dean Pearson, was a dairy farmer, and dairy farmers were struggling in 2008, 2009, and 2010, which is when he killed himself. We also had pork industry troubles in the late 90s, and of course the farm crisis in the mid-80s. So the financial reasons certainly come into play. You also have social reasons. Farmers are very proud people, and they're often quiet people and reticent, and they're less likely to seek help than others. They spend all day tolling away. It's hard, manual labor. Sometimes they're doing it alone. Lack of resources in mental health resources in rural communities. We see a lot of these coming together. There's also some interesting reasons that are still need some more research, like the pesticides issue. Some researchers in the past couple of years have linked pesticide use to causing depression. And a lot of farmers have said, well, that's why they're killing themselves. So we see all these issues coming together, but we have to also keep in mind that every person is different and that we need to look at each individual case.
One of the challenges in reporting on an issue like suicide, especially in a context of looking at occupational and demographic issues, is it can be hard to sometimes find numbers. How did you go about that? And I understand that you did find that the rate of suicide among farmers is greater than the rest of the U.S. population.
Yeah, so talking about suicide with people, there's always going to be a stigma about that. And just 2 days ago, Newsweek posted a short follow-up article that I wrote about better understanding what's going on here. That's on their website. And there I go into it a little bit about how the numbers are hard to determine because not everyone who's out farming calls themselves a farmer. And some suicides do get mislabeled, misreported as hunting accidents or tractor accidents or not reported altogether. But speaking with suicide prevention advocates for the agricultural communities, they pointed me to different studies over the past 10 and 15 years, and that's where they get this main number that American male farmers are killing themselves twice as often as male non-farmers in America. But those numbers are likely to be underreported. The numbers in other countries are way higher, and those are a little bit more concrete. Like in India, the number is 270,000 farmers since 1995. That's one every 30 minutes. In France, the number is one every 2 days. So these numbers are up all over the world.
In your piece, there's a point where you talk to one individual and they say they didn't really know that this was a problem, but when they thought about it, you know what, I do know a farmer who took his life. And that's something that we hear here in Central California as well, many times an anecdote. Is it something that people just don't want to think about? Do you think the stigma behind suicide has let this phenomena of farmers taking their lives go underreported from a media sense as well?
Well, I'll speak to the media sense in just a moment, but farmers certainly, again, they're such proud individuals that they really don't want to talk about the struggles in their communities, and I don't think we could blame them for that. And so, yes, I'd be speaking to all these farmers, and they'd say, you know what, I never heard of this trend, but come to think of it, I know three of my buddies who have killed themselves in recent years, and that came up more than a couple of times. Now, in terms of the media reporting on it, I think media does tend to shy away from suicide stories because there's this fear of copycat suicides. And it's not just a fear, it's a big problem. But there's a way to cover suicides more effectively so that you're not encouraging others to do what you're talking about, this horrible thing. And so I was very conscious of that, and I consulted different guides out there by the World Health Organization and the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention.
This also brings up the issue of mental health in rural America. In many cases, farmers are living in rural communities that don't have the access to the type of mental health resources that we would find in the big cities. There was recently a study that looked at mental health in California counties and not surprisingly found that this is a larger concern in areas that don't have access to those types of services. Do you think this paints also a larger picture of mental health in rural communities and on the farm?
Oh, absolutely. You know, not everyone in rural communities obviously is in farming, and also some farmers aren't in rural communities.
Yeah.
But this article certainly focuses on the rural aspects. A lot of these studies with which I consulted not only discussed farmers, but also people in rural communities as general. There's less resources, and that's a big problem.
So what can be done? Let's turn the discussion to forward-looking. You mentioned you talked to one organization, FarmNet. They aren't a suicide prevention hotline, but they've taken a number of calls from farmers who are in desperate situations. Is there an effort perhaps afoot to develop some sort of response plan or extra tools and reaching out to farmers who are facing these problems?
There are, but they're going through their own challenges. I write about Sowing the Seeds of Hope, which was a Midwestern farm crisis hotline. It started in the late 90s. It went until around 2010. And they were getting thousands of calls, some of which were just for a little bit of assistance. Some were suicide calls. But they ran out of funding. They had been running on private grants as well as government funding, and that ran out shortly after the recession. So now, yes, we have New York FarmNet, which is based out of Cornell University, and similar programs called FarmLink. I believe Vermont has an effective one. And some of them are going strong. Others need more support from the government. A lot of suicide prevention advocates had hoped that there'd be something about mental health for farmers written into the new farm bill, which was long awaited and just came out this year. Unfortunately, nothing of the sort was written into those. So I think a lot of these hotlines, some of which started back in the 80s during the farm crisis and have continued today, like New York FarmNet, are going to be struggling in years to come.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition today, our guest is Max Kuntner. He is the author of a cover story in Newsweek magazine called Death on the Farm that exposes the significant problems dealing with suicide amongst America's farmers. And it's an issue that certainly hits close to home in Central California. We've seen similar stories, specifically in the dairy industry, of folks here in Central California who have taken their own lives. I'd be interested, though, do we have any information or any data? Does this transfer from farm owners to those who work on the farm workers, maybe those who are migrant workers or others who are working in the fields? Do we see similar numbers there? Have you seen anything along those lines amongst those who aren't necessarily farm owners?
I'm glad you brought that up, Joe. And farm workers, and especially the migrant worker issue, is huge right now. I think it's rather new, and so as is anything in talking about farmer suicide. And so those numbers, to my knowledge, don't exist. I hope and I think that we'll see them in the coming years. But I think a lot of these things would hold true. Yes, being a farm owner and the generational issues and wanting to save the family farm is very significant. But still, being out there working with pesticides, if that turns out to be linked to depression, which researchers believe it is, being in rural communities without the same mental health resources that urban communities have, those would certainly apply to farm workers, not just farm owners.
Again, we've been talking with Max Kuttner, the author of Death on the Farm. It's a new cover story in Newsweek magazine. You can find it online at newsweek.com and on newsstands as Newsweek has returned to the printed page. Max's story profiles the epidemic of suicides among America's farmers. Max, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Valley Edition. Today is Earth Day. Here in California, a state that is often at the vanguard of the environmental movement, one of the biggest issues of 2014 is hydraulic fracturing, also known as fracking. This controversial practice has been employed for decades in California to extract oil from the ground by injecting water, steam, and a variety of chemicals deep into wells. Together with new technology like horizontal drilling, fracking has producers scrambling to unlock vast quantities of oil trapped deep beneath the ground of southern and central California in a formation called the Monterey Shale. Concerns about the environmental costs of fracking, from air and water contamination to possible seismic activity and CO2 emissions, have led to a series of bills over the past few years in Sacramento seeking to slow or even halt the practice entirely. Last year, California Governor Jerry Brown signed into law a bill that imposes new regulations on hydraulic fracturing, including permitting requirements and disclosure of some of the materials injected into wells. This year, a new Senate bill would actually impose a moratorium on fracking. Joining us now on Valley Edition is one reporter who has been following the issue very closely. Amy Quinton covers the environment for Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. You've heard her reports on fracking and other issues on our program before. She's part of a new collaborative report on fracking with CPR and Sunset Magazine. She joins us now on Valley Edition. Amy Quinton, welcome.
Hi there.
The current bill that recently advanced in committee in the Senate, what would it do?
Well, that's SB 1132, and basically it would put a moratorium on fracking until there's a study, a scientific study that takes place. And now this is a broader study than the one that was called for by the fracking bill that was signed into law just last year. And Senator Holly Mitchell, she's the bill's author and represents part of Los Angeles, she's basically arguing that fracking shouldn't be allowed to continue while these new regulations that were signed, you know, into law last year, fracking shouldn't be allowed while those are taking place because there's just too many unknowns.
Do we have any idea of how those regulations are playing out in the real world right now? Are they achieving the intended effect?
Well, right now we're in a stage of interim regulations. The big regulations take effect next year, and that's going to require the oil companies to actually do this permitting process. But a number of things are sort of working their way through, one of them being the bill, which is SB 4, requires oil companies to monitor groundwater. There's a process where they have to notify neighbors near a wellhead that they're going to be doing hydraulic fracking. It requires also that oil companies disclose what chemicals they're using in the well stimulation process. And it also, like I said, requires this scientific review. And originally, this is interesting, originally the bill had a moratorium component, but that had so much pushback from the industry and other legislators that it ended up being removed.
And what are the chances, given the shifting landscape, especially in the California State Senate just in the last 2 months with the suspensions of three senators, what are the chances that this bill this year moves forward, whereas last year that same effort failed?
Well, I think it's actually going to be more difficult because not all Democrats are behind it. 2 years ago when a fracking moratorium came up, it didn't come close to getting the votes it needed when it reached the floor. Senator Fran Pavley, who wrote SB4, like I said, originally had that moratorium. She knew that she couldn't get that bill passed unless she took the moratorium component out of it. So it's not just that these three senators are no longer there. I think it's a more difficult fight, but you never know.
Governor Brown has been very optimistic when talking about the Monterey Shale and its potential for increased revenues for the state and increased oil production in California. How does his support factor into this effort to further regulate fracking?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't call him a big backer of fracking, and I say that because he is the one that signed SB4, and that has become law, and that is putting forth these, you know, pretty stringent regulations, according to the industry anyway. So there's that. But, you know, obviously he realizes there's a huge economic part of the economy that comes from oil production. One only needs to look at Kern County to figure that out. And, you know, there were some fracking protesters at the state Democratic Party mm-hmm. convention that interrupted his speech. And he basically said, now, wait a minute, you know, there's 330 billion miles a year that Californians travel in their cars. So, you know, we have to face reality here.
Now, supporters of fracking say it's been going on for decades in the state's oil production in Kern County and beyond. But there's a lot more increased scrutiny of this practice now as the potential for the Monterey Shale formation becomes more realized by technologies such as acidization and horizontal drilling. Is the Monterey Shale driving this?
I think it is. I mean, there's a lot of untapped oil there, and that's something that certainly oil companies are looking at. I mean, they will also tell you that extracting that oil is very, very difficult. You know, California has seismic risks that it has to deal with. From my understanding, the Monterey Shale formation is more like a marble cake when it comes to its geology as opposed to being like a layer cake. And so that makes it even more difficult. But assuming that they can capture this oil, that is what a lot of environmentalists are afraid of. It's just going to be this boom, say, like it is in North Dakota right now.
You've been reporting on this issue not just as part of your regular duties with Capital Public Radio and those stories that air here on our station as well, but also in a collaborative project with Sunset Magazine. Tell us about how that came about and what you've been reporting on there.
That's right. We've been in a collaboration with the Food and Environmental Reporting Network. You can find them online, as well as Sunset Magazine, which, you know, people, everybody's asked, Sunset Magazine is doing a story on fracking? Well, they've actually sort of taken a new editorial turn and are doing some more in-depth stories, and fracking was one of those. So I collaborated with Barry Yeoman, who wrote the article for Sunset Magazine, and you can find that online as well. His part of the collaboration looked more at the science and what is going on in the Monterey Shale, and I looked at more of the regulations. So it was a collaborative process. I think it worked well.
A few years ago, there was an effort in another part of the state bureaucracy, outside of the state legislature, but in the Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources, to implement their own regulations on hydraulic fracturing. Has that process gone away, or is it superseded by the bill that Governor Brown signed into law last year and then this new effort towards a moratorium?
That's right. You know, I was curious, actually, what happened to those regulations. But my understanding is that SB4 basically took over that law. So any regulations now on fracking come from SB4. Besides the stuff that Dogger, that's what they call the Division of Oil and Gas and Geothermal Resources, is doing, they normally did sort of well design and permitting, which is a little different than sort of, you know, the regulations for fracking are pretty intense under SB4. So they're pretty much going with those. They don't have any other regulations.
You mentioned the seismic risks. That's something that opponents of fracking have brought up many times in talking about the impacts to the environment. Water is also a concern, not only the water consumption, especially in a drought year like this, but also water contamination. There was a situation last year in Kern County where some fracking fluids were being dumped into an unlined pond. Are you seeing more focus on that water aspect? And what are you hearing in terms of your reporting on the concerns about groundwater?
Well, I'm hearing two things, one with air quality and the other one with groundwater. I know the video you're talking about actually got posted to YouTube. One of the things that the industry has to do with these new regulations is they have to do groundwater monitoring. They also have to capture that fracking fluid. What you saw in that video and what happened in Kern County is no longer going to be able to happen, apparently. They're going to be capturing all the wastewater and putting them into containers that are actually capped. That's what they're supposed to do, and Dogger is supposed to be regulating that. So hopefully that kind of thing won't happen again.
The other concern that was also partially addressed last year but not to the satisfaction of many environmental groups is disclosure, disclosure of what exactly is going into the ground. Where does that stand with the law right now?
Well, basically the oil companies have to disclose all the chemicals that they're using, with the exception of those that are considered a trade secret. How will somebody know what those chemicals are? Anybody that lives within the area of a wellhead, it will be written on the permit. The permit will also be online so people can find out exactly what those chemicals are.
It's a very interesting story, and we will continue to follow it. We look forward to more of Amy Quinton's reports again. We've been talking with Amy Quinton. She is an environmental reporter with Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. Amy, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment here on Valley Edition as we talk about the upcoming election and find out which races are the ones to watch. For political junkies across Central California, John Ellis with the Fresno Bee will join us coming up here on Valley Edition.
Valley Public Radio's wine tasting is less than 2 weeks away. Join us at the Lester Estate in Fresno for the 30th anniversary, Sunday, May 4th. Mastering the Art of Wine will feature wine from over 40 vintners and delicious hors d'oeuvres from Chef Roy Harlan of the Elbow Room, plus live music and a silent auction. Round-trip bus transportation is available for our South Valley guests. Tickets and details for Sunday, May 4th are available online at kvpr.org.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. California's June primary is just over 40 days away, and that means up and down the Valley, campaigns are kicking into high gear. Here to tell us more is John Ellis, state and local politics reporter with the Fresno Bee. John, welcome.
Thank you, Joe.
I want to talk about some individual races in just a moment, but before we do that, water politics is at an all-time high, or I guess you could say all-time low, depending on your perspective, right now with the drought. Senator Feinstein has made some changes to her Senate bill in regards to drought relief in California water that would supposedly make it more palatable for Republicans in the House. Should we expect any meaningful legislation out of Washington when it comes to water and the drought? And do you think that water is going to play a decisive role in any of the races that we're seeing in California this year?
Well, first of all, the decisive role part, yeah, I don't think so, because, you know, if you listen to people, really, if you want to talk about this, you have to get to, like, probably the, you know, the state and especially the federal races, which would be Congress, and they all have the same opinions. You know, I mean, you listen, I mean, it may be degrees of separation here, and it's a lot of acrimonious finger pointing. Let's take, you know, for instance, in the Valadao Renteria race, and then there's John Hernandez who's in that race. I mean, they all agree we need more storage. They want more dams. They want, you know, more water banking. I think if you got down to the nuts and bolts, you might get some differentiation on, you know, changing the Environmental Protection Act. But, you know, let's face it, you know, that is probably not going to happen. You know, everybody, I think, around here, if you want to be a politician of any worth your salt to win, you know, you cannot be against, quote, against water. And I mean, it's kind of a ridiculous statement because, you know, I mean, water is such our lifeblood here, and if our ag industry really needs it. I don't know if that answers your question, but we could have a whole show on water, you know. But, you know, Feinstein, yeah, in the House. I don't know. You know, I just think there's the politics there, and I think her and Devin Nunes just have such a, you know, they're oil and water. There's just not a lot of common ground there on a personal level. I don't think either side has reached out to the other side to truly forge some compromise. Yeah, in the long run, I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on here. There's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of different parts of the state with constituencies that conflict with one another. How you balance all that You know, I mean, that's supposed to be what they make the big bucks for in Washington.
Moving on to some of these individual races in the primary, one of the most watched ones, and not just locally but nationwide, is in California's 21st District. Republican David Valadao is facing two challengers in a district that leans towards Democrats. There's a lot of buzz about Sanger's Amanda Renteria, who's raised a lot of money in the race. John Hernandez is also aiming for Valadao's seat. Valadao beat Hernandez last time. He's also been one of the most outspoken Republicans in favor of comprehensive immigration reform. Does he still have an edge on Democrats in this race, do you think? And can he pull out another victory in this case? Or is Renteria the strong candidate that Republicans have been fearing in that district?
Well, I think that she could be, and I think she has all the tools to be the candidate that they fear. And they probably do fear her. Now, they're probably never going to say they fear her, but, you know, when you have that much money in, you know, you've raised, you know, $600,000 in the last 6 months, that's like, I guess, averaged out like a clip of $100,000 a month. So, you know, I think she's proven herself, you know, a capable fundraiser. She has not even started spending her money yet on what we would call mass communications, which would be, you know, any sort of radio, television, or even mailers that go to camp, you know, the voters' mailboxes. So I think right now, the funny thing is, you know, 2 years ago, John Hernandez was an afterthought. The Democrats kind of got behind Blong Zhang in that race, and he ended up losing to Hernandez, and Hernandez went on from the top two primary. He went on to face off against Valadao in the general, and Valadao just killed him. You know, Hernandez has no money, but he has, you know, decent name ID, and, you know, he is a Hispanic representative of a majority Hispanic district. So Renteria is, I think, a little different is that she is as well, and she's a capable fundraiser, and so she has, you know, Emily's List and all these, you know, organizations that give to Democratic causes. I mean, you know, not to mention the DCCC itself. Which Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, they're, you know, almost all seem to be, you know, behind her, and they seem to think this is the one. And if you look at the grift that cranks out of the National Republican Congressional Committee, they you know, you can just judge and look at that and think, okay, yeah, they obviously think she's somebody that they need to watch out for. And, you know, and all the prognosticators, and like you said, you know, the voter registration favors Democrats. It's a majority Hispanic district, so district was drawn for a Hispanic Democrat, but if you look at, well, Hispanic Democrats never held it. You know, a Democrat did kind of hold it in a slightly different iteration, Jim Costa. Now his district has moved to the north. The district lines kind of changed. But, you know, Valadao is, you know, he's the incumbent, and the incumbents win a vast majority of the time. He's proven already now twice, once in the state assembly and in this very seat 2 years ago, that he can beat the odds as far as registration and, you know, goes and being a, you know, just kind of being a non-Hispanic Republican. So that's why I give him the edge, only because of that. I mean, to me, when you're king of the mountain until somebody knocks you off. Now, can Renteria knock him off? I think she can, and I think that's why when you look at, you know, all these prognosticators like, you know, the Cook Report and Rothenberg Report and Larry Sabato's crystal ball, I mean, they have it as a toss-up but leaning Republican. And I think that makes sense because, you know, like I said, he's the guy. You know, he probably, you know, by all measures, he probably shouldn't be, but he is. And until he's not, you know, I think that's why you kind of put it as a lean Republican. And, you know, the Democrats have got to do a better job getting the vote out. Democrats, they admit it. They do not do a good job. They've got this registration advantage, but they don't get those people to the polls. And that is job one. You know, stop. I mean, keep registering by all means, but you got to get them to vote. You can't just have them register and then sit home on election day.
I want to turn now to another congressional race, and that's Jeff Denham's seat a little further up north in the valley. Michael Eggman, his sister is a state assemblywoman. He is running for this congressional seat. He's a farmer and a beekeeper. A lot of people late last year were talking about him. Has the buzz maintained around Mr. Eggman? That was
nope,
not planned
no pun
there.
Intended,
nope,
no pun intended.
It was not intended, but it happened.
You know what? Once again, the astronaut Hernandez a couple years ago, right? He was supposed to be the guy, and I don't know. I think that's a tougher road for Democrats. You touched on immigration, that both Valadao and Denham were two of only three Republicans to sign on to that Democratic-backed comprehensive immigration reform bill, which would include a pathway to citizenship for those here illegally. And so they are trying to, I think, steal the thunder of the Democrats' best arguments. And I look at that race just like I look at the Valadao race, and that's that Denham is the king of the hill, and he actually turned back, I guess, you know, in comparison to Valadao with Hernandez, I would say a more formidable opponent, only because he was better funded and, you know, had a pretty good pedigree in that he was, you know, an astronaut and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, Eggman, once again, the advantages that the Democrats can try to work up there are not quite as advantageous to them as, I think, in the 21st. Denham's district used to come into Fresno County, but when they redrew it now, it's completely in Stanislaus and a little bit in San Joaquin counties. And so not quite as diverse a population, not quite as high of an advantage for the Democrats up there. So that's my take on that race. And, of course, we can't forget that all of this plays into national strategies. And if they're going to, you know, it all comes down to money, and do you have enough money to get your message out? I mean, you can't be a terrible candidate, but the best candidate needs a lot of money to be able to knock off an incumbent. And, you know, the Democrats have to defend some seats. They got to make sure that Ami Barra keeps his seat. He's got some high-profile Republicans taking him on. They've got some other seats, Southern California. I think what the Mary Bono Max old seat down there in the high desert is they got to try to hold on to that. And, you know, and then nationally too, you know, there's only so much money to go around. And you talk about the party, you talk about the big party donors, and, you know, so the big question becomes, is Eggman worth the investment that it would take? There's probably an algebraic formula to figure it out. It could be several million dollars. And, you know, in the grand scheme, is that worth the investment to try to take that seat away when there may be other seats that are more winnable? So I think that conversation is going on at probably high levels, and they're trying to probably put the puzzle pieces together to figure it out. And I think Renteria is actually they probably look at this as a real worthwhile investment.
Again, we're talking with John Ellis of the Fresno Bee on Valley Edition today. It seems like just a year ago, Andy Vidak was running for the Senate. In fact, he was. It was a special election to replace Michael Rubio. Vidak defeated Leticia Perez from Kern County, a Kern County supervisor. He's now facing off in another challenger in the regular election for this seat after that special election last year. Does Vidak really enjoy the benefits of incumbency, given he's just been in the Senate for a short time?
Well, he is in the – yeah, I guess he does, technically. And he ran – you know, his name has been really out there for a long time because he really gave Costa a good run for Congress in 2010 before ultimately losing by 3 or 4 percentage points. And then because the race came up as a special election after Michael Rubio resigned, it was just a year later. So his name was almost continuously in the news. You know, I think Democrats would point out, and they would – be correct in doing so, you know, that was a special election. Special elections always favor Republicans because, historically speaking, their turnout among their, you know, their, once again, the district is very similar to Valadao's. In fact, it's bigger because there's only 40 state Senate districts in California divided by 38 million people. So it's actually, there's 58 congressional seats. So it's a much different dynamic in that our state senators represent a lot of people. But I think almost every stitch of Valadao's congressional district is covered by Vidak's state Senate district. So you can draw some conclusions. You know, once again, you have a Democratic voter registration edge. You have Hispanic, who historically have been historic Democrat supporters over the decades. And so if you look at those seats, they're very similar in that respect. And so special election, Democrats have traditionally low turnout. Leticia Perez, who is a very capable administrator down there in Kern County, and I've got to know her in the election. She's a very good person, but you know, she let the Sacramento Democrats run her campaign, and they did a poor job. I think she never really hooked on here in Fresno, as she did down in Bakersfield. And you really, when you run in those seats, you need to run very strong in both Bakersfield and Fresno, Kern County and Fresno County, because you're going to get whooped. There's no doubt. There's no two ways about it. You're going to get whooped in Kings especially and Tulare. Those are very strongly Republican counties, and that's Vidak's home territory. So you've got to counter that. And, you know, so Leticia never caught on up here in Fresno. So Luis Chavez, see, he just doesn't – first of all, he doesn't have the name ID that – you know, well, you know, he's probably maybe where Leticia was. He needs to probably go down to Bakersfield and get known down there so he can run strong down there too. But so you look at that seat and you think that, you know, he should have a really good chance because Vidak just won in a special election. This is not a special election. This is a general election. But then you look at other things. You know, you got to look at all these dynamics that play. One of the things that Republicans are in deep fear of, at least the prognosticators, if Tim Donnelly is the nominee for governor, he is so anti-immigrant, and it comes through so much that he could actually drive up Hispanic turnout. And if he does that, then they, you know, then these prognosticators think that not only Vidak but Valadao could be in trouble because you could see this flood of Hispanic voters who want to cast a protest vote for Jerry Brown for governor. But that aside, they've been talking about a depressed turnout because, you know, it's the sixth year, you know, kind of Obama fatigue, maybe a little bit. Jerry Brown is probably going to just walk into another, you know, term in office, so there's not a lot driving the Democratic voter to the polls. So I guess we have to see what's, you know, are there going to be any sexy ballot initiatives that drive turnout? So if not, you know, maybe those are all could be good or bad for Vidak, could be good or bad for Chavez. I think we just got to see how it all plays out in the end. But once again, if you look at the numbers, Chavez should have a chance. There's no real reason that Vidak should hold that seat. But when Republicans are so, you know, they're looking at the seats that they can defend, and they think this is one they can defend. So I think they're going to probably fight to hold the seat. You've already seen the Democrats give $300,000 to Chavez. So they said even the playing field. So they look like they're going to put some money here too. And the Democrats in California have a lot of money. And if they really want to go after this seat, they maybe – because I think they viewed it as their seat. You know, Rubio was a Democrat. He held it. Dean Flores was a Democrat. He held it. Jim Costa, when he was in the state legislature, so this is a long-time Democrat seat. And so I think the Democrats look at this seat and they're like, what is a Republican doing in this seat? So, yeah, that could be a good race. But just so everybody knows, there's only two people in that race. So in June, it's going to be like a practice run under the top two primary. They'll run, but the results will mean nothing except it'll just be a measuring stick of sorts. Of course, the primary voter, a lot of times different than the general election voter, but it will kind of give them a free poll. They'll be able to see where they stand. The real election for that seat, because there's only two of them, is November.
Unusual indeed. Let's turn now to Fresno County politics. One of the most heated local races in Fresno County is also one of the most perplexing, I guess you could say, and that's the Fresno County DA's race between incumbent Elizabeth Egan and challenger Lisa Sundergaard-Smitkamp. Is this race a clash of ideas or a clash of personalities?
Well, probably a little bit of both. I think, and believe me, there's a gulf in between the people here, and this race has been very ugly, and I think largely because it has divided not only the law enforcement community but the legal community and the political community. All three, they've kind of split, and because both Smitkamp and Egan are Republicans, and so everybody's picking sides, and so it's getting ugly. And when you get, you know, Republicans picking sides in Fresno, you know, that's where a lot of the money is, that's where a lot of the power is. And you get a lot of people who end up not liking each other very much. There'd be a lot of hurt feelings. Residual resentment after the election. This, because there's only two of them and it's a county level election, this will be over in June. You have Egan, who's been there since 2002, unchallenged in 2006 and 2010. There's been grumblings about her. You know, I'm a politics writer, but because of the way things work here at the B, we're a jack of all trades. I've found myself in the courts on occasion. I know a lot of the lawyers in town. I've done some federal court work, and so you run across lawyers and people talk, even, you know, in that area. And there have been some dissatisfaction among a certain segment against Egan. Now, if it's fair or not, maybe it's just your point of view. I think finally you had Lisa, who was really Lisa Sundergaard professionally all the way up until she decided to run. And then she put the Smitkamp onto her name, which probably was a smart move because the Smitkamp name is certainly well-known all across Fresno, you know, Wawona and Lyons Magnus and just the business and agriculture empire that the family has. So I think that helps her. She has money either through the family or through some of the people that I've just talked about, because it's just a divisive race. So you've got people giving to her. You have the law enforcement community is totally split. You know, the FPOA, the Clovis police officers, are behind Smit Camp. The Fresno deputy sheriffs are behind Egan. I think it's a clash of ideas, really. There's allegations that, you know, that Egan's doing a terrible job running the office. She's part of the reason for the backlog in the courts because of how she chooses to prosecute cases that she micromanages, especially through her number two man, Kelly Keenan, and that she's chased away quality prosecutors. Now Egan just says, you know, hey, it's attrition. It's you know, we've had pay cuts. People moved on. They moved on to better jobs for higher pay. And, of course, she denies a lot of the other stuff. You know, she says free communication in the office up and down, hasn't heard anything, and would change, you know, would be willing to listen to anybody if they don't like the way things are going. So, actually, I think there's a lot of, you know, they're debating about conviction rates, you know, and I think it's probably a worthwhile endeavor to try to figure out, you know, who's telling the truth. You know, Egan says 92%. Smit Camp says she's getting it from the state judicial council, 52%. So, stats, as a guy told me, you know, stats can lie. You can make stats say anything you want stats to say. So who's right? I don't know. But that is it's taking the air out of, I think, every other race locally, because it has become so acrimonious, especially not among the average voter, though. I think if you talk to the average voter, they're wondering what all the ruckus is about, because the DA is a position. People don't really pay attention to that position. It's not like it's a taxing authority, or it's not like the, you know, and Egan especially has not been on TV a lot. She hasn't been out there. She's not a real activist district attorney. She's not on there like Dyer, you know, Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer, although that's not an elected position. But he's everywhere all the time in his uniform, and he's talking, he's on TV, and he doesn't have any hair on his head. So, you really can't miss that guy. And you see him on the street, you know who he is. I think, you know, if you talk to 100 people on the street and said, find Elizabeth Egan in the crowd, they wouldn't be able to do it, because I just think it's low-profile position, but obviously, if done wrong, could have a big impact on your life. Now, like I said, there's certain part of the legal community that says things are going horribly wrong, and I think that's what Smit Camp's responding to.
At the same time, there's several Fresno County supervisor seats up this year. There's been comparatively little discussion, at least compared with the very heated DA's race for those races, yet at the same time, the county supervisors really control the purse strings of the county and have a big impact on the lives of every county resident. What's happening in those races? Blong Zhang, who sits on the Fresno City Council, is running for a seat. There's a number of others, some familiar names, some less familiar names. What's happening with the Fresno County supervisors' races?
Well, I think those positions are ones that probably have more direct impact on your life than, certainly I think probably more than the, say, the district attorney or the sheriff. I mean, those guys control the budget of the district attorney's office and the sheriff's department. You know, and when the DA's office employees get pay cuts, it's not Elizabeth Egan giving them the pay cuts, it's the supervisors. You know, the DA's race, for instance, the whole county will vote for that. District 1, which is Phil Larson, he's retiring. That's only going to be people in District 1, which is the western part of the city of Fresno, and then going all the way out to the western edge of the county. You know, so that's Kerman and Mendota and Firebond, Coalinga. And then you look at Judy Case's seat, District 4. That's south and southwest, Sanger, Kingsburg, Selma. And so only those people in that seat will elect those people who are replacing the two retiring supervisors. And I think the interesting that you have two supervisors retiring at the same time, that's just very uncommon. There's no term limits. So, you know, a lot of times these people serve a long time. So now you have two, and as it is now, you know, why this is, I think, particularly important from anybody's point of view, if you look at this, is that it's really been it was a 4-1 split. I mean, Henry Perea, basically the lone Democrat, the lone, I think, you know, guy who kind of is supportive of, you know, the labor unions that are active with the county employees, and whether they're getting a fair shake and the pay cuts affecting everybody. I mean, not just your janitors, but, you know, all the way up to the people I was just talking about, you know, deputy district attorneys. So you could see a swing here. You know, if Blong Zhang were to win, and if, you know, there's a couple of Democrats down, Danny Parra is one of them, Magdalena Gomez, I mean, if they could win,
then all of a sudden Perea could find himself in the majority, from minority right to the majority, boom, because there's only five total people on that board. You know, and then Debbie Puchigian has been kind of a lightning rod for a lot of people. She is in a kind of a shaky coalition now because it's been her, Phil Larson, and Judy Case, and they're both retiring. Andres Borges, who took over Susan Anderson's seat, is a Republican, but he's clashed with Debbie. So, you know, if she, the wrong people get in there, you know, she's been kind of a very much of an activist supervisor and a very strong personality on there. She could be knocked back, you know. And so you have Brian Pacheco, who she is backing, and Phil Larson is backing, and that's Phil Larson's seat. He has a boatload of money. He has a lot of these. He's a Democrat, but he has a lot of endorsements from these Republicans, and he has a lot of money, and he's a Kerman dairy farmer. And then you have Gary Yep, the Kerman mayor, who says, I'm the only Republican in this race. That's his whole calling card. And so he is trying to I think, in a way, undercut Pacheco, because Pacheco has Republican support, but he's a Democrat. And Yep saying, but I'm a Republican. So he has the backing of, like, the Republican Central Committee and some hardcore Republicans who say, hey, you know, he's the Republican, let's vote for him. And Pacheco has come under fire because he worked for Costa. He supported Jim Costa, the longtime Democratic legislator. Then on top of that, you have Wang Zhang, the Fresno City Council member. They think he'd be a strong union voice, kind of more liberal-leaning Democrat. And so, you have two Democrats and one Republican, and one of those Democrats has Republican support. And it's kind of wacky in that seat, nonpartisan. But we all know, I think if you pay attention, you're going to find out what the political parties are for all those. Down in Judy Case's seat, Buddy Mendez, the Riverdale farmer, has a ton of money, a lot of support. You know, on both these seats, I think, because there's other candidates I didn't mention in District 1, and then District 4 has multiple ones as well. So you may see, what you're probably going to see, is you're probably going to see no candidate get 50% and win outright in June. So the top finisher and the number two will go on one-on-one in November. But yes, very, very important races, very important races, and they're just drowned out, I think, by the DA's race probably. It just seems to be this, all of a sudden, just evolving into the 100-pound gorilla in the room.
Before we go, one last look at a statewide race, and that's the one involving Fresno's Republican mayor, Ashley Swearingen. She's running for state controller. She is facing off against two Democrats. A recent poll showed Swearingen actually out in front, thanks to the Democrats splitting their vote. Does she have a chance to move on to the November election?
Oh, I think she absolutely does. And I think the key for her is, who does she face? I mean, there's, you know, November, there's been talk of, even though John Perez is the Speaker of the Assembly, talk that he might be the better opponent for her, because taking on Betty Yee, she's another female, and if you're a Republican running, you need every advantage you can get. And so the thought is that if Ashley ran, she'd be a Republican, and she'd be the only woman, though, against John Perez, that she may actually pick up some support from independents that she absolutely must have, because the registration advantage is, you know, statewide is huge. I mean, you know, right now, as it is now, you know, there's no Republicans holding statewide office. None of the row offices are Republican, and it's just a tough road. And Brown's gonna, you know, he's gonna cakewalk to re-election probably. And so, yes, does she move on in June? She probably does, and for just the reason that the field poll showed, that Yee and Perez are going to split the vote. There's another Republican in the race from down in California City, but it doesn't look like he has much money. Not that Swearingen has a ton either so far, you know, although her campaign consultant has, you know, said $5 to $10 million is his goal. We'll see what happens, and if he can actually get to that goal, she's going to need it. I think their strategy is to not overspend in the primary. They're going to try to eke through the primaries and save all their bullets for November, and that's when they're going to try to spend and cruise through on her Republican credentials in the primary election, and trying to get to the general, where then she would try to make an all-out effort.
Certainly something we'll be watching as the election season marches on. John Ellis, state and local politics reporter, joining us today from the Fresno Bee. John, thank you so much.
Anytime, Joe.
Well, that does it for another Valley Edition. We hope you enjoyed today's program. As always, you can let us know what you thought. Send us an email at talk@kvpr.org or tweet us @KVPR. For producer Ezra David Romero, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.